From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. I guess we have another late night ahead of us. It's Game 3 of the World Series. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk about the series with sports writer and NPR commentator Bill Littlefield. His new book, Baseball Days, is a celebration of the game. Also today, we meet one of the emerging young stars in jazz, Joshua Redman. The 24-year-old saxophonist is largely self-taught, in spite of the fact that his father is free jazz's Dewey Redman. John Leonard reviews Strange Pilgrims, a new book of stories by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And writer and single mother Anne Lamott tells us about her son Sam's first asthma attack. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. More nations have agreed to provide warships to help enforce the United Nations embargo against Haiti. 9 American and Canadian vessels are already on station off the Haitian coast. Britain, the Netherlands, and France are also reported to be sending vessels. Speaking today on CNN, General Raul Cedras said that the sanctions won't solve the problem. Analysts tended to agree with the top military man, saying the Haitian army is believed to have up to 3 months' supply of oil. 750 members of the U.S. Army Ranger Task Force will soon be heading home from Somalia. President Clinton ordered the pullout of the elite unit that had gone to Mogadishu to try to capture Mohamed Farah Aidid. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
The withdrawal of the Rangers reflects the administration's efforts to shift focus to a political rather than military solution in Somalia. That effort began after the October 3rd raid by Aidid's forces that left 18 Americans dead. 16 of those killed were Rangers. Pentagon spokeswoman Kathleen Dulaski characterized the withdrawal as a confidence-building move for the Somali people.
The U.S. is happy with, is pleased with the progress on the ground in Somalia, the fact that there has been a ceasefire in place, it seems to be holding, at least for the time being.
The Rangers' departure does not end the U.S. capability for what is known as shock assault. 3,600 Marines are now standing by off the Somali shore. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Republican leaders in the House have outlined a proposal to reform the way congressional campaigns are funded. The GOP proposal would ban all special interest contributions. But Democrats are still working out the details of their package and may miss a self-imposed deadline for bringing it to the floor. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Republican campaign finance reform plan differs from what Democrats have been talking about in several key areas. Democrats want to include some type of public funding of campaigns, which Republicans oppose. And Democrats want to limit special interest contributions by political action committees or PACs. Republicans would ban them outright. Louisiana Republican Bob Livingston says PAC contributions give an unfair advantage to incumbents.
Currently, all PACs give $94 million to incumbents and only $12 million to challengers. Obviously, the incumbents have the advantage. We want a level playing field. We would ban PACs.
Democrats, meanwhile, are still drawing up their plan. They're aiming to bring it to the floor by the end of next week, but that timetable may slip to the first part of November. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 3,635. Declines led advances by almost 2-1. This is NPR. Conservationists say that the United States is more heavily dependent on imported oil now than it was after the 1973 oil embargo. On the anniversary of the embargo, public interest groups released a study showing that the United States now imports 43% of its oil, up from 35% in 1973. Joan Claybrook, the president of Public Citizen, said that President Clinton's new action plan doesn't pay enough attention to the need for fuel efficiency. Spanish officials suspect that the Basque separatist group ETA carried out the killing today of a Spanish Air Force general in central Madrid. The attack comes even as the government insists that ETA is on the decline after a 25-year struggle for the independence of Spain's Basque provinces. From Madrid, Al Goodman has more.
The Spanish Air Force General Dionisio Herrero was shot near his home while heading for work as Director General of the Air Force Hospital. Masked gunmen fired about 14 shots, killing the general and seriously wounding his military driver. The assailants fled in a car, but left it nearby, rigged with a small bomb. That explosion reportedly injured a passerby. Officials said the bomb was a diversion to help the gunmen escape. ETA has killed more than 700 people in its long fight for the independence of Spain's northern Basque region. Today's attack came as Spanish police kept searching for a Spanish businessman kidnapped by ETA last July. The government says that despite these activities, most of ETA's leaders are in jail, and election support has declined for a political party linked to ETA. For National Public Radio, I'm Al Goodman in Madrid.
Three major pharmaceutical companies have announced big cuts in their plants and workforces. Pfizer Incorporated said it would eliminate 3,000 jobs worldwide. Upjohn said it would close or reduce 14 of its 31 plants, resulting in about 1,500 job losses. American Cyanamid said it expects to cut about 2,500 jobs. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The World Series continues tonight with Game 3 in Philadelphia. What better time to wax poetic and complain about baseball? You probably know my guest Bill Littlefield as a sports commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. He has a new book called Baseball Days, From the Sandlots to the Show, that celebrates baseball and all its manifestations. Littlefield also has a new book for young people called Champions, profiling 10 athletes. I asked him who he's rooting for in the series.
I find that I'm split on this, Terry. My heart is with the Phillies. Unfortunately, my head is telling me that the Jays will probably prevail.
You think they're the better team?
Yeah, I think pretty much down the line they're the better team. They're the better dressed team. They're the better shaven team, all those things.
Do you like to see the better team win or your favorite win? I mean, do you think there's a certain order that prevails when the better team wins?
Well, when we get into the postseason and the Red Sox aren't involved, which is much more often than not, I root for the game itself. I root for good baseball, and that means I root, in the case of the World Series, for a seven-game series with lots of drama building toward the end. And so that's what I'm hoping for this time, too.
Do you think that each of the teams kind of epitomize a different baseball style?
Well, the teams, the players on the team certainly present themselves that way. The Phillies seem to be so determined to present themselves as the team of character and the team that's a throwback to the old days where you only had one pair of pants, so when it ripped, you couldn't change it. You know, John Kruk had three pairs of pants in his locker that night of the last game of the playoffs, so he could have changed his pants. And I was a little surprised to see that he had a clean pair on once the series began.
The Toronto Sun is promoting the series with a cartoon image of a player called Fat Phil. That's P-H-A-T, Fat. And he's a pot-bellied, bearded batter weighing himself on a scale. And, of course, the scale is busting because he's so heavy. Do you see Kruk as a kind of throwback to the Babe Ruth days of athletes where people were kind of, you know, some athletes were pot-bellied but still played a good game?
Yeah, sure. And it's not only to Babe Ruth. It was much more contemporary player. Yogi Berra said, it's a good thing you don't hit with your face because I would have been in trouble.
Is it my imagination or is there more spitting than usual during this series?
It's either that there is more or that the cameramen and camerawomen have decided to focus on it more frequently. I think there's a certain perversity operating. They not only are catching people spitting all the time, they're also catching poor Jim Fregosi smoking in the dugout. And I think there may be some in-joke among the technicians or something.
Tonight, the designated hitter rule won't be in effect because they'll be playing at the Phillies' home stadium in the National League. And The Blue Jays lead pitcher said that he swung the bat only three times since high school. He says, I haven't seen a pitch since 1986. If I make contact tonight, I'll be happy. What impact do you think it'll have on the game to be playing without the designated hitter rule tonight?
Well, the American League is at a disadvantage, of course, because they are accustomed to the designated hitter, and their teams in the American League are built around the opportunity to use the designated hitter. I'm actually one of the very few people who follows baseball who's in favor of the designated hitter rule, and I recognize that it takes strategy out of the manager's hands, But I appreciate it because it gives old guys an opportunity to keep playing. And I wouldn't be still playing fast-pitch softball in Cambridge if there were no designated hitter rule. I can still limp to the plate and hit the ball. And we have this situation where sometimes we do a kind of a relay race and somebody jumps in halfway down the first baseline and runs for me.
What seems to you to be the best stories to have emerged so far from the first two games of the World Series?
Oh, I think one interesting story is that starting pitching hasn't been the story at all. You know, the old chestnut wisdom in baseball is that starting pitching that good pitching always beats good hitting, and the starting pitching has been very disappointing, I think, for both sides. So that kind of throws the whole thing up for grabs, and I suppose that works finally in Philadelphia's favor if the series becomes unpredictable, then the unpredictable team is most likely to prevail.
Bill, how do you like staying up past midnight to watch a game?
I don't. That's one of my gripes. I really look back with nostalgia to the days of day baseball, even in the postseason. I remember I used to have, when I was in elementary school, a World Almanac, which I had cut the center out of. And I had a little transistor radio built in that I could fit into the almanac, and used to hold the almanac to my ear in the corridors in school. We weren't supposed to have radios, of course. And I could keep track of the World Series that way. That kind of mischief, it seems to me, was a pretty important part of of growing up. And kids now, my gosh, you know, they're so sleepy. If they do stay up and watch the World Series, they probably miss school altogether. I think they would be better off with the portable radios listening to afternoon games.
In your career, you haven't done daily sports writing. You haven't written for a daily, or you haven't written regularly for a daily. The kind of writing where you're commenting on games day by day and you're going into the locker rooms to do the post-game interview. Why haven't you done that particular brand of sports writing?
Well, the short answer is that nobody's asked. The long answer is that if I can avoid it, I would prefer to. The closest I ever came to writing about sports as a beat man was during the playoffs in the World Series in 1986, when the Red Sox made it to the playoffs and then subsequently to the World Series against the Mets. And it was extraordinary for me because my wife had just given birth to our first child. So at home, we had a screaming baby who was waking up at all hours to be fed, and I was getting home at 3 a.m. from games, which, like the games in the World Series going on right now, were ending far too late. And then I had to, as you say, go into the locker room, do all the interviews, truck the tape around, and file the story. And I came out of that experience wondering how anybody does it. And I didn't even have to go to the second city. I was only covering the games in Boston, so I didn't have to go to New York when the game shifted to Shea Stadium. I really prefer an opportunity to sit and think a little bit and work more sane hours. And as long as I can make the nut doing it that way, I'll continue doing it.
When you were doing the locker room interviews in 86, was there a feeling of pointlessness about it, in the sense that you knew that they weren't going to really tell you anything?
Well,
anyways,
that's part of the pointlessness, but that's only the tip of the iceberg of pointlessness. Believe me, one of the most awful things that happened to me in that series was I went into the New York locker room, and at one point, and there was a pitcher sitting there with a giant ice bag on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the National League players. You know, I don't follow the National League regularly all year. I'm an American League guy in an American League city. So I see this guy with his giant ice pack on his shoulder, and I went up and I started asking him about the game as if he were the pitcher who had just, you know, come out of the game, because he did, after all, have this huge ice pack on his shoulder. And it turned out that he hadn't pitched that night at all. And he looked at me for a while I went on with my dithering, silly question, and then he gave me a response which I can't repeat on the radio, and basically told me that probably I'd gotten my press credential out of a cereal box and should go somewhere else. I'm not crazy about working in locker rooms.
How did you feel after that? Were you very
awful.
Embarrassed?
Yeah. I was hopelessly embarrassed. The only thing that I was thankful for was there wasn't anybody else around to hear it. You know, nobody was paying too much attention to me because they were all too busy asking the players what pitch they had hit and whether they had a chance to come back and win three in a row or whatever else predictable questions they were asking in order to get their predictable answers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Littlefield, and he's a sports commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He has two new books. One is called Baseball Days, From the Sandlots to the Show. He also has a new book of profiles of athletes written for young people, and that book is called Champions. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Talking about baseball, back with Bill Littlefield. Bill, you did a commentary on Morning Edition back when the Seattle Mariners were up for sale, and you suggested that you should buy the team, and with the help of listeners who should send in $2 each. And
right.
I loved your suggestions of how you should rename the team and what the team, how the team should be changed. You want to go over that with us?
Sure. It was my my soupy sales impersonation on radio.
Oh, right, get your
from
mom
the days
to,
when
yeah.
Scrape the change off your dad's bureau, put it in an envelope, and send it to me. What I said was that the Mariners were available for $100,000, but times being what they were, I thought probably the owner, Jeff Smullyan, would take $89,900, and with the help of the listeners, I thought probably I could scrape the down payment up. And numbers of people did send in money.
I think one of my favorite suggestions was that you swore you would trade any player who referred to himself in the third person.
Yes.
Why? That's the thing with politicians and athletes that I really don't understand. What is behind this phenomenon?
I think if you talk to the players, the guy who did it when he was here in Boston was Wade Boggs. And when he would go into a slump, which was rare because Wade Boggs was and still is a wonderful hitter, you'd talk to him and he'd say, that was not Wade Boggs up at the plate today. And you'd pause and then you'd say, well, who was it? He had your uniform on, Wade. You know, if you ask them why they do it, and some people used to ask Boggs why he did it, and he had this feeling that, in fact, it was a way to express his humility, that it was a humble way to refer to himself. He didn't want to say, I, so he called himself Wade Boggs. And, of course, the effect was precisely the opposite of what he apparently had intended.
So, Bill, what did you do with the money that the listeners had sent you to help you buy the Seattle Mariners?
I signed all the checks and sent them to the Boston Food Bank and wrote letters to all the people who wrote in and told them that their money had gone to help feed people who might not otherwise be fed and that they should all take an appropriate tax deduction. Needless to say, we didn't have enough to make even a vaguely credible offer to the Mariners. I think we came up with about $60 after this campaign.
Right. Now, you've been writing about sports for a while. Were you an athlete when you were young?
That's the charitable interpretation of what I did. I played well enough to have a good time playing a lot of sports, but nobody ever confused me for a prospect. There was no possibility I'd ever be mistaken for one. But I loved the game, and I played all the time. And when it was winter, I played basketball and hockey, and when it was spring, I played baseball and played all summer and enjoyed it and still play. And I think one of the nice things about baseball is you don't have to be terrifically talented and gifted in order to go out and have a great time throwing the ball around and hitting it and playing the game.
Your brother played in the minor leagues for a year.
My brother-in-law, yes.
A brother-in-law.
My brother-in-law, yes. He played in the Minnesota Twins organization, dropped out of college to play for 1 year, and has never regretted it. And as a matter of fact, we had a conversation. What I laughingly refer to as research for this book, Baseball Days, involved going to a lot of baseball games, some of them minor league games in great minor league parks, beautiful places. And one night, my brother and I went to the AA ballpark in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is on an island in the middle of the Susquehanna River. You go over the bridge and then you exit, and it looks like you're going to just drive right into the river. And all of a sudden, here's this little island, which is mostly a baseball park, beautiful park. And we were sitting watching a game, and it had rained earlier in the day and discouraged a lot of people who might have gone to that game, so it was not a full house. And as we watched the game, and my brother-in-law became sort of more and more enchanted by the game going on in front of us, I turned to him at one point and I said, you only played 1 year in professional baseball. And he'd always told me before that his curse was that they tried to turn him into a power hitter. He was an outfielder who was really a contact hitter and a very fast base runner, and they tried to turn him into a power hitter, and they ruined his swing. And then he got released at the end of his 1 year. And I said to him, if it had happened another way, if you had gotten every break, if you'd had coaches who really recognized your strengths and let you build on them rather than trying to turn you into a different kind of hitter, how high could you have gone? Now, he played in the old Western Carolina League, which was about as low as the minor leagues go, lower than they go now. And he looked at me with absolutely clear eyes, no irony in them, and he said, I could have played in the big leagues. And I'm sure that almost everybody who's ever played and signed a contract, played well enough to sign a contract, believes that they could have. And I like to believe that he could have, and I think he could have. I saw him, of course, much later as still a very good athlete. But that dream never dies. And I think that's one of the things that carries baseball. You know, unless you weigh 280 pounds, you can't say, I could have played in the National Football League. And unless you're 6'10", you can't say, I could have played in the National Basketball Association. But you can be a normal-sized guy and have some skills, and you can dream about playing in the big leagues.
Yeah. You write a little about the minor leagues in baseball days. For some people, the minor leagues are like the last bastion of the true spirit of baseball without the commercialism and the TV cameras and everything. And for other people, it's just like the tacky, low-budget version of baseball. So which is it for you?
Oh, it's a marvelous combination of both. On the one hand, it's good baseball. I mean, AA, for example, that game that I saw in Harrisburg with my brother-in-law was a terrific game, and everybody on both teams was on their way up. You know, every kid, as I said, was dreaming of playing in the big leagues, and it was great fun to try and spot the kids who might have a shot. On the other hand, tacky doesn't begin to describe some of the things that happen in minor league parks. They are trying to make a dollar. And so you got the dynamite lady who packages herself in a cardboard box at home plate and blows herself up at a different minor league park every night. You got all these crazy promotional stunts where if you turn to page 13 in your program and your number matches the one that the PA announcer reads off, you get a free ice cream cone at the Dairy Queen or $5 worth of dry cleaning at Sid's. You know, I mean, it goes on and on. Between every inning, you get this stuff, and it's very schlocky and silly. And but the hot dogs are hot and the beer is cold, and on a nice night, there's no better place to be.
So you're going to be watching the game tonight?
I'll watch it for as long as I can stay awake. I hate to admit it, but it's hard for me. I have a day job, you know. I'm a college teacher at Curry College out in Milton, Massachusetts, as well as a sports writer and a book writer. And the day job sometimes dictates that I actually go to sleep before the World Series games are over.
Bill Littlefield is the author of Baseball Days and a book of profiles for young people called Champions. It can be pretty scary when your child is sick, maybe even scarier when you're a single parent. Anne Lamott joins us with another journal entry about her life as a single mother. Her son Sam is 4.
Sam often crawls in bed with me in the morning. He's so light that I don't always feel him get in, but then I'll hear this little baby longshoreman voice growl, "Move over." Other times he bolts up to a sitting position, shakes me awake, and says hostily, "Your bed's wet," like I'm the one who wet it. But the other morning after he'd climbed in, he said in a strange voice, "Your bed is too hot for me," got up and went to his own room. Thinking he must have a fever, I followed, and it turned out by then he was panting. He couldn't breathe. Half an hour later, we were in the emergency ward. As it turned out, Sam was having his first asthma attack. It was a bad one. I've never seen anyone have an asthma attack before, and I thought he was going to die. No one in my family has asthma, and I have no idea whether or not his father did, or whether it runs on the father's side of the family. I know that both of Sam's father's parents were old and alive during the 3 months we were seeing each other, and you know what? That's about all I know. Sam's pulse was clocked at 150, and his chest was rising and falling like a piston, and I was suddenly keenly aware that Sam is half made up of someone whose parents' names I don't even know, let alone anything about their medical history or their son's, Sam's dad. Of course, this was one of the first things the doctors in ER wanted to know. "I really have no idea," I said. I felt like the fast girl in high school who doesn't know for sure who the father of her baby is. I wanted to explain that I'm not that kind of girl, that there'd just been one man. But Sam was sitting right there, wheezing away, staring at me with his huge brown eyes, plenty anxious enough without having to deal with his most painful issue. This business of there actually being a man out there who is his father makes him so confused. I recently went into more detail about it than I ever had before, explained to him that his father got very angry at me when I was pregnant and had gone away long before Sam was born, and that Sam simply couldn't see him. Sam volunteered a couple of ways in which I might improve my personality enough so that his dad would not be angry anymore. "Honey," I tell him, "it just isn't going to happen." And in what I think of as real life, it doesn't usually bother me that there's no one around but me. But in the emergency ward, watching Sam gasp for breath, the aloneness bothered me big time. It made me feel like a hugely burdened adolescent, like Atlas in junior high. Nurses came in from time to time to give Sam another treatment, and once to take us down the hall so Sam could get a chest x-ray, and the doctor kept coming back to see how Sam was doing, but mostly, for 3 hours, Sam sat up in bed and I sat beside him. No one offered us any toys, and I hadn't thought to bring any. I kept thinking that if there were a dad here, he would know what to do. He could do sound effects for Sam to make the time pass. This is the one field in which I would definitely acknowledge general male superiority. But I remembered the old adage that first you take the action, and the insight will follow. So I found a tiny box of crayons in my purse and 2 index cards with shopping lists on them. I drew a terrible giant on each of the index cards, poked holes in each of their right hands, and stuck tongue depressors through them. Then I staged a vigorous clicking sword fight between the 2 giants. Sam's eyes grew wide. He smiled. It felt like one of those tiny little brown paper bag miracles, and even more so an hour later when he could breathe again just fine. And I could finally see that we'd never really been alone, because Sam was sitting there on the bed, covered with funny stickers on his clothes that various nurses had given him, every step of the way.
Anne Lamott is the author of Operating Instructions, a journal of my son's first year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the story of how one reluctant jazz musician came to record with Charlie Hayden, Billy Higgins, and Pat Metheny. We talk with 24-year-old saxophonist Joshua Redman. He'd decided not to follow in the footsteps of his father, saxophonist Dewey Redman, but circumstances decided differently. Now he's one of the most popular young jazz musicians. Also, John Leonard reviews a new collection of stories by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to top Pentagon officials, a freighter was allowed to continue on its way to Haiti today after being stopped by a U.S. ship enforcing a new U.N. embargo. The ship carrying cement from Belize was the first to be challenged under this new ban against oil and arms, and cement is not covered by the embargo. Last week, the U.N. Security Council voted for new sanctions because of violations of an agreement to turn over power to a democratic government. Chris Nuttall of the BBC filed this report from Port-au-Prince.
Haitians in the capital reacted to the reimposition of sanctions by bolting their doors at night, emptying the streets of Port-au-Prince, and conducting business almost as usual by day. Markets were bustling with plenty of fresh produce available, and there were no queues at petrol stations, with oil supplies still believed to be plentiful. Many stores and offices remained closed. At a news conference, a spokesman for the American embassy said it could be 2 to 3 months before oil supplies reached a critical level. Stan Schrager said the United States was prepared to wait it out and had no plans for further negotiations. Mr. Schrager said Coast Guard cutters were out at sea with the warships to intercept any Haitians taking to the boats to seek asylum in the United States.
Chris Nuttall reporting from Haiti. On Capitol Hill, the House may have dealt a knockout blow to a giant atom smasher now being built in Texas. The House has turned down a compromise that would have provided money for the superconducting supercollider. NPR's Joe Palca has more on the story.
The Clinton administration says the $11 billion supercollider, or SSC, will provide important science and create jobs. But opponents say it's just too expensive. Earlier this year, the House voted to remove funds for the SSC from the Department of Energy's budget. But last month, the Senate voted to put the money back. A House-Senate conference went along with the Senate version, putting $640 million in the budget to continue work on the supercollider. But the House rejected the conference committee's compromise. The House instructed its representatives to the conference to rework the deal, removing money for the SSC. New York Republican Sherwood Bollard is an opponent of the project.
We're sort of in a high-stakes game of chicken. I mean, this can go back and forth. We haven't heard the end of it.
The conference committee is expected to meet soon. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
And the government says that home construction improved again last month as mortgage rates fell to their lowest point in 25 years. The Commerce Department says that new home construction was up by 2.8%, with a big increase in apartment building. It was the highest rate of construction in 3.5 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 7 points to close at 3,635.32 on volume of more than 296 million shares. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, Muslim and Croatian forces exchanged hundreds of prisoners today in a move under the direction of the International Red Cross. Meanwhile, thousands of people have fled new fighting in Bosnia, most of them women, children, and older people. According to Croatian radio reports, Bosnia's Muslim-led government force launched an artillery attack on a Croatian settlement yesterday afternoon in an area not previously under attack. UN officials are trying to put together new peace talks among the various warring factions. In New York City, the UN Security Council has voted to condemn violations by separatists in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia concerning an agreement signed last July. It was the second rebuke issued by the Council in just over 1 month. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
In its vote, the Council comes down squarely in support of maintaining the territorial integrity of Georgia. It also calls on all states to prevent separatists in the breakaway region of Abkhazia from receiving weapons and other assistance. The Council also welcomes a decision by Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali to send a fact-finding mission to investigate reports of ethnic cleansing. But the vote falls short of Georgian calls for UN peacekeepers. Meanwhile, Georgian leader and former Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze has called for military help from Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan to secure key transport links that were cut in another separatist upheaval in the western part of the country. So far, only Russia has responded by saying it will not intervene alone, and any action will be limited to reopening a key transport link for supplying Russian units based in Georgia. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Officials of Upjohn have announced plans to cut some 1,500 jobs. The company also plans to either close or cut back on production at 14 of its 31 plants. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. Saxophonist Joshua Redman is the son of saxophonist Dewey Redman, but it's not just Joshua's jazz lineage that's impressed jazz critics and fans. Last spring, when his debut album was released by Warner Brothers, critic Gary Giddens wrote, "The album is one of the most impressive debut albums I've ever heard. Redman is a tenor saxophonist of extraordinary promise, already mature beyond his years." On Joshua Redman's first album, he played with musicians of his generation. His new album is a companion session featuring some of the veteran musicians he most admires, guitarist Pat Metheny, bass player Charlie Hayden, and drummer Billy Higgins. From the new album, this is Redman's own composition, Wish. Joshua Redman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
I think listeners who hear that you're Dewey Redman's son may assume that you grew up with him and, you know, played with him from a very young age. But in fact, you were brought up by your mother in Berkeley on the opposite coast from where your father lived.
Exactly. Yeah, and I hardly ever saw my father. I would basically see him whenever he would come to town to play music, which would be usually at the most once a year. So I had very limited contact with him. And he was We weren't close, but there were people also have to understand that there was no resentment. I never felt bitter towards my father in any way. I never felt like he should have been there. I never felt like he had shirked his responsibilities for me. I mean, I, you know, had great love and respect for my father, but he just wasn't a father to me so much as a musician that I really respected and a man that I respected.
How well did you know his work? Did you have his records in the house?
I knew his work better than I knew about just about anything else about him. I mean, that was a part of his life that I was the most familiar with because I had, if not all, I think I have all his records, and I had almost all of them as they came out. He would always send copies. So he was one of the first musicians that whose work I really became very familiar with.
So when you came to New York and started playing music, did you start hanging out with your father a lot more?
Well, when I came to New York, I started playing with my father pretty regularly in his group. I became a regular member of his quartet and played at the Vanguard many times with him, the Village Vanguard in New York City, and played in many other cities. And eventually in 1992, went on tour with him to Europe. So, I started to be around him a lot more because I started to play music with him more.
I want to play something from an album you recently recorded with Dewey Redman. This is called Formo, and he's featured on alto. You're featured on tenor. You want to say anything about it?
The record as a whole was one of, up till that point, it was one of my favorite records that I had been on, because it was the first record, I think, that I did that actually represented a group that had been working together on somewhat of a regular basis before the recording. I'd done about 7 or 8 recording sessions before that one, but all those had been kind of like these throw together sessions, which a lot of the times is how jazz is recorded these days. You get kind of a bunch of name players together, rehearse them for a day if you're lucky, and throw them in the studio and tell them to make, you know, inspired music, which can happen, but the music is always the most inspired, I think, when it's the product of many months of working together and getting to know each other as musicians. And that's what this record was.
This is from the album Choices, Dewey Redman on alto saxophone, Joshua Redman on tenor. Joshua and Dewey Redman from the Dewey Redman album, Choices. Joshua Redman, your new album features Charlie Hayden on bass, Billy Higgins on drums, Pat Metheny on guitar. How did you put together this group?
Mm-hmm. I settled on this group because they had a very unique sound. There's a mood that they evoke as a rhythm section that is so different and so special, and something that I've never heard even approximated by any other rhythm section. Not to say that it's better, but it's just so different, and it was something that I felt I really needed to experience, and that I wanted to, that I didn't think I would have any other opportunity to experience except with them. You know, they really had a strong connection, partly because I think of they all had a really deep association with Ornette Coleman's music. I mean, Charlie and Billy were part of the original quartet, which came to New York and played at the Five Spot. Ornette Coleman is just, Pat's number one musical idol. I mean, that's all he talks about, you know, a lot of the time. And he did do a record with Ornette. And the three of them, Pat, Charlie, and Billy, had done one record together called Rejoicing, which is one of my favorite jazz records. And so, you know, there's something that I think, because of that connection with Ornette, and also they all had a strong connection with my father, which was another reason that I kind of wanted. I thought it would be an interesting way to pay tribute to my father without actually having him on the record, because I didn't want to make a record with my father. I wanted to define myself separately from him, but at the same time kind of pay tribute to his influence.
Why don't we hear the first track from your new album, the Ornette Coleman composition, Turnaround?
Great.
Tenor saxophonist Joshua Redman from his new album, Wish. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Joshua Redman is my guest. Your mother brought you up in, mm-hmm. in Berkeley. She is a dancer and librarian?
She is a librarian now. She was a dancer until she had injuries. So she actually had injuries shortly before I was born. So ever since the time that that I was, you know, around, she never danced professionally.
So did you grow up in artistic circles?
Well, I mean, I didn't... Yes, I did. I grew up with art all around me. I mean, she was interested in all the arts, in music, in dance, in theater, in the visual arts, and exposed me to everything. I grew up financially very poor. We were on welfare. But culturally, I think I was very rich because she made sure that I was exposed to almost everything that I could be exposed to.
You went to Berklee High School. You played in the high school jazz band. You were also the valedictorian of your class. So what took up more of your time when you were in high school, studying or playing?
Oh, studying, definitely. I mean, academics were always my first priority. Music was always... It's funny because music was always, in a sense, the most important thing to my heart, to my soul, you know? I mean, that meant the most to me, but it was never something I wanted to pursue as a career. In fact, I think I almost actively, you know, fought against pursuing that as a career. Like,
did that have something to do with your father?
It didn't have to do, well, it may have had something to do with the information that I had about my father's life. In other words, my decision not to become a musician, or what I thought was going to be a decision not to become a musician, had nothing to do with the fact that my father was or was not a musician. But knowing that he had had such a hard life and that he was a great musician but had never been able to, you know, have the success that he deserved and never been able to support a family and had a very hard time just even putting food on the table, knowing how hard it was to be a dedicated, principled musician, knowing that from observing his life, I think that may have influenced me, away from a career path in music.
So what were you thinking your future was going to be?
I went through a lot of different stages, but by the time I was like a junior in high school, I was pretty set on being a doctor, a physician. I really wanted to be a pediatrician.
And you went to Harvard Pre-Med?
I went to Harvard Pre-Med, but that means that you only take the 4 required courses necessary to apply to med school.
When you got to Harvard, mm-hmm. was race much of an issue there for you?
It was more of an issue because for the first time in my life, I felt like there was pressure on me to make a choice between either, you know, hanging with whites or with blacks. I grew up in Berkeley I'm from mixed parentage, and I, you know, always had friends from all ethnic groups, from all racial groups, and felt like I could float easily between them. I felt like there weren't as many rigid racial boundaries. And when I got to Boston and to Harvard, I really felt like there was much more kind of self-segregation among the different groups of students, and there was more pressure to make a decision.
Okay, so you graduate high school valedictorian, you go to Harvard on a scholarship, pre-med program, then decide you want to study law afterwards, mm-hmm. got accepted, I believe, to Yale.
Yes.
And then took a break, went to New York, played music, and never went back to academia.
Not yet.
After that. So what changed? You had decided you did not want the musician's life. You saw the trouble that it could be.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, in addition to my concerns about not being able to, you know, have a stable economic existence with music. I mean, that was something that worried me. But there was another reason why I was very frightened, I think, about pursuing music as a career option. And that was precisely because I was afraid of what would happen to the creative spirit when it becomes kind of subordinate to the economic need. In other words, what happens when the thing that means the most to you spiritually and soulfully also becomes the thing upon which you rely to put food on the table, your source of income? I was afraid of somehow the creativity being corrupted by the professionalism, you know? And that's something that I'm fighting with right now, you know? It's very difficult to maintain that sense of innocence and freshness and inspiration about art when you're doing it night after night and you're working hard and doing interviews like this all the time and have not that much time to actually devote to your music. It's hard to stay inspired, to stay fresh, and that's one of the true tests of being an artist, being a good artist, you know.
So what was the turning point when you decided you were going to stick with music and not go back to academia?
Right. Well, I moved to New York. I started playing a lot. I moved into a house with a bunch of musicians. I started playing a lot of jam sessions. I played around town some. I started listening to, I'm going to clubs all the time. And eventually, I was playing with my father, like I said. And in September of 91, I entered the Thelonious Monk saxophone competition. Kind of against my better judgment in a lot of ways. It was something that I did not want to do and entered it at the very last minute.
You didn't want to do it because you don't like the idea of a competition? Or
I didn't want to do it because I didn't like the whole... There's something about the philosophy of a jazz competition. There was something that seemed... It was almost a contradiction in terms. There was jazz is subjective expression, whereas a competition presumes that you can somehow judge people based on some formula of objective criteria, you know. And you know, the idea that you can somehow place people's music in some kind of hierarchy and say his music is better than his or hers, that bothers me, you know. So I had philosophical problems with it. I also had practical problems with it because I thought I just had no chance at it. So I really, you know, I kind of, everyone was telling me to enter it, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. But for some reason, and honestly, I can't really figure out why I actually did, but I just kind of on a whim at the last minute, you know, prepared my tape, sent it in, and was accepted to the semifinals, went down and performed, made it to the finals, and ended up winning. And winning the competition brought me a lot of attention from everyone in the industry, and it also brought me a lot of attention, which was the most important thing. It brought me a lot of attention from musicians. And by the beginning of 1992, I began to get calls from people like Charlie Hayden, Elvin Jones, Jack DeJohnette, and began, you know, John Hicks I recorded with, Paul Motion, began working and recording with these people. So basically, I became addicted to it. You know, I realized that it meant even more to me than I thought it would. And I also realized that I had been fortunate enough to been placed in a position where I could see a decent living being made out of, you know, out of being a musician. You know, I was making enough to survive and play the music that I wanted to play, which is more than a lot of people, you know, who deserve it, get. I mean, it's as much as I could ever ask for.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Joshua Redman's new album is called Wish. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing about day one of sanctions imposed once again against Haiti because of what happened when a boat of U.S. Military personnel tried to land there. Also today, the Israelis free a Palestinian who had been held for more than 20 years, freed at the personal behest of Yasser Arafat. And David Wellner reports on how the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, is playing out in the politics of Mexico and what kind of controversies have been engendered there by NAFTA.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new collection of stories from the award-winning Latin American writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He's best known for his novels 100 Years of Solitude, Love in the Time of Cholera, and his last book, The General in His Labyrinth, about the life of Simon Bolivar. John Leonard has a review of Strange Pilgrims.
From Garcia Marquez, instead of a symphony, some chamber music. As if these 12 tales of Latin Americans abroad had been written for lute and cello, harpsichord and horn. Strange Pilgrims also represents the return of the Nobel Prize winner, with dancing feet, to magical realism, at which he is every bit as accomplished as Bach was at quartets. Not only his New World students, writers, newlyweds, prostitutes, and magicians, but his old worlders too, in Spain and Italy, Paris and Geneva, Vienna and Sicily, tripped the light fantastic. A diplomat in exile ages faster in photographs than he does in the mirror. The Pope in Rome, with burnished nails and a lavender smell, is incapacitated by the hiccups. A German governess drinks port, quotes Schiller, smells of monkey urine, and kills herself. How is it that so many Europeans, besides eating rabbits and snails, also dine on a stew of songbirds? A tenor sings at a lion, and the lion sings back. A dog knows how to cry. In full evening dress, with a fresh gardenia and patent leather shoes, and eyes the color of the sky at dawn, a drowned man looks up from the Bay of Naples. And you don't want to hear what happens to the poet Pablo Neruda on a Barcelona stopover on his way back by boat from Rangoon to Valparaiso. After his Bolivar book, Garcia Marquez is playing. But what is he playing at? Well, just listen to what happens to his Latin Americans. A father from the Andes travels to Rome to seek from three different popes sainthood for his 7-year-old daughter, whose weightless body in a cello case refuses to decompose, as the rose in her hand refuses to wilt. A thoughtful and pretty young Mexican music hall singer, married to a cabaret magician, is driving back to Barcelona when a breakdown of her car lands her in an insane asylum, where she will spend the rest of her life making artificial flowers to pay for her cigarettes. 2 young Caribbean boys, having asked for and received in landlocked Madrid a rowboat and diving equipment, manage somehow to drown themselves in electric light while their parents have gone out to the movies to see Last Tango in Paris. Having dined in Tuscany with a Venezuelan writer and gone to sleep in his ghostly rented castle, a married couple awaken in the morning to the scent of fresh strawberries in another century in a bloody bed. And so it goes. The Brazilian mulatta in Barcelona, who is an anarchist and a whore, the Colombian in Vienna, who sells her dreams, seeds of madness on the Costa Brava in the Tramontana wind, a trail of blood from the Pyrenees to Paris, poisoned oysters in a Naples hotel, major surgery, tenor saxophones, and a patron of the arts devoured by his own dogs. I don't want to make heavy weather of this floating music, but you see, blood, dreams, madness, drowning, songbird stew, and artificial flowers. It's as if these Latin Americans went to Europe, for whatever reason, only to find exactly what Europe shipped out to Latin America in the first place, 500 years ago, a kind of passionate cannibalism. And all that Latin America has to show for this transatlantic vampire exchange is glorious literature. Garcia Marquez.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Strange Pilgrims by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney, research assistants from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Terry Waite was negotiating for the release of hostages in Beirut when he was taken hostage himself, then held in solitary confinement for 4 years. Recently, Oliver North admitted that Waite was used as a pawn by the U.S. government to get information about the hostages. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Terry Waite. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.